Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of You're the Cure. I'm Dr. Ben Edwards at Veritas Medical. Website is veritasmedical.com. You can check out all our old shows there. And we have a lot of good shows on that archive page related to COVID in particular. We've really focused on early outpatient treatment. We've interviewed Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. Ben Marble. We've had Richard Bartlett on. And we've also talked some about the vaccine. Today's show will be focused on adverse events that are being reported from the vaccine on the VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And we've got Dr. Jessica Rose with us today to discuss this system and her analysis of this system. Dr. Rose was recently testifying at the FDA to the FDA last Friday, along with some other colleagues of hers that have analyzed this data, and they were giving their opinion to the FDA. Those opinions apparently carried some weight because the FDA voted 16-2 to not endorse booster shots. So we've asked Dr. Rose to come on and talk about that. And just in general, talk about vaccine safety and efficacy. And let me just frame the conversation real quick, and our long-term listeners understand where I'm coming from. And where I'm coming from is our immune system is designed beautifully. If we'll steward it properly, it will be well. Pre-1910-ish, when Rockefeller and Carnegie got together and hired Abraham Flexner to canvass all the medical education curriculum in the country. And he came back with the conclusion there were too many different curriculum. We needed to standardize to the allopathic model. And at that point, homeopathy and all the other ancient traditional healing arts were marginalized and even criminalized. So this 100-year experiment we've been under with treating symptoms instead of dealing with root causes has landed us in a place where only 12% of Americans are metabolically fit. So what does that mean? That means your mitochondria that produces energy can do it effectively and efficiently, and it can also deal with the free radicals, the exhaust that's created by that energy production. Metabolic fitness is key to health. Go back to 1900, 50% of kids did not make it to their fifth birthday. A high mortality rate from infections, measles, diphtheria, typhoid, whooping cough in 1900, 50% mortality rate. But we saw a 99% drop in this mortality rate starting in the early 1900s. And by 1940s, 1950s, by the time the vaccines came out, there was a 99% drop in mortality rate. How did that happen? Mostly because we figured out we needed to clean up the environment. It's more about the terrain than it is the germ. And as we brought sanitation, clean drinking water, good sewage, and just overall sanitation to these inner cities, the mortality rate dropped. So now we're not dealing with external terrain issues. We all have running water and commodes in our home and good sanitation. But internally, our sanitation is horrible, primarily because of the big three: processed vegetable oils, processed sugar, and processed grain. These quote-unquote foods, processed food-like substances, drive an internal inflammatory environment so that our internal terrain is so dirty, we're sitting ducks to these germs. So I'm not going to discount the fact that we're an unhealthy people group, that we are susceptible to disease. And I know ICUs in Lubbock and Texas in general have been pretty filled up, and I'm sensitive to that. But my main message is, let's get to the root of it. And can we throw some rescue countermeasures into the mix to help people that have not stewarded their health and that are very, very sick and inflamed, and this virus is overcoming them? Can we do something to help them that will decrease their risk of severe symptoms, hospitalization, ICU admission, and death? And I think we've laid out a good case in previous shows that we can indeed do that with early outpatient treatment. The other option is to consider this new gene therapy technology that's never been brought to market before, although it's been tried in the past, but the adverse reactions were so bad, it could never pass the animal safety studies. But now we are proceeding in a human trial with doing this. So we need to consider safety and efficacy. Does this medical device and procedure work? And if it does it work better than early outpatient therapy? And if it does, is it also safe? Are the unintended side effects — every medical device and manipulation by man into this human physiology can have an unintended consequence, side effect, we call it. So we've got to judge that. efficacy, and safety. So Dr. Jessica Rose will bring her expertise into the conversation to discuss these two very things. The safety and efficacy of the COVID-19 quote unquote vaccine, I like to more accurately describe it as gene therapy because it's what it is. So Dr. Rose, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate you being with us.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Well, and I didn't even read your bio. And in fact, I think I'm just going to let you, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience, kind of a little bit of your background, and then let's jump into safety and efficacy.
All right. Or lack thereof.
Yes.
My name is Jessica, and I am a kind of a researcher of all trades. I'm kind of a biologist who does every kind of biology using math as an analytical tool. So I have a few degrees. I'm calling myself a viral immunologist. The viral part comes from the fact that since I can remember being alive, I've been fascinated by viruses. And my immunology degree was the hardest and the most fascinating one that I did. So immunology, for anybody who knows, is the craziest, most dynamic field that there is, I think. Maybe some people will disagree with that, but it's pretty dynamic. And I got interested in VAERS because I was on a little bit of a sabbatical, I guess it, or a hiatus from my research as I just finished my last postdoc. And I wanted to teach myself how to code with R. So I needed a data set in order to do that. So I chose the VAERS data set and it became very interesting very quickly. And since then I've basically my life is devoted to data analysis of this specific data set and letting people know what I'm seeing.
Okay. Well, that's a great little background. And I want to remind our listeners that from a physician standpoint, I graduated medical school in 2002, UT Houston, and I do not recall in medical school training hearing the term VAERS or Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. I did not know it existed. I don't recall that in residency either, where I was chief resident of my class. And in my 7 years of private practice in Garza County, I don't recall remembering any continuing medical education that taught me about VAERS. So what I'm saying is many doctors didn't even know VAERS existed. And thus, I think that's partly leading to the underreporting that we see historically. That's just a side note. So people, again, framing the conversation when we start talking stats here, many, many doctors didn't know about it, probably more do now because it's somewhat in the news. But I will also say doctors are not trained to recognize adverse events. So many doctors may be looking at an adverse event in the eye, meaning looking at a heart attack, a stroke, a pulmonary embolism, some neurological disorder, immunological disorder, autoimmune flare, like an MS flare all of a sudden comes out of remission. And they won't relate it to the vaccine because we're not taught to connect that dot. So those are two pieces of information also that we need to frame that conversation. But so go, please, Dr. Rose, continue as you decide to use the VAERS for your this data set. What did you find? What did you see?
Well, first of all, just in case we forgot to mention, VAERS is an acronym that stands for Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. So most people are interested in how many people are dying in the context of a treatment or a biological that's being, you know, used in humans. That's meant to help us. You know, there's the issue of safety and efficacy, of course, is the cornerstone of any product going into humans for use, either as a pharmaceutical or a biological. And death, of course, would be like the very worst outcome that you can have as a byproduct of a new product being used. So I started there. I looked at death. I extended to severe adverse events, which includes death and hospitalizations, emergency room visits, disability, life-threatening illnesses, or birth defects. These numbers are also I noticed back in the time when I started that they looked like exponential growth curves. Then I categorized the adverse event classifications into categories. The categories were cardiovascular, neurological, and immunological, because I'm not an MD, but I know a lot of medical jargon. So I started seeing, A, that there was an enormous number of adverse event types being reported, and that they could be lumped into a category, like cardiovascular injuries, for example. I plotted those as well against the update dates, which come in every Friday from VAERS, and those curves also looked exponential. So what I started seeing was a trend among just about any adverse event that was standalone or grouped of exponential growth. And not only that, I mean, you can have an exponential growth curve where the scale is very small, but that was the difference here. The scale, when you compare and contrast the adverse events from 2021, is not comparable to the scale if you compare it to any other year for the past 30 years that VAERS has been in existence. So that was the big safety signal being thrown off for me. There's very anomalous findings coming out of VAERS. And the question then became, two big questions. One, what's the cutoff number for deaths? Because the last time I checked, the last time a biological product was rolled out into humans and people started dying, which was for the H1N1 product, the cutoff number for deaths was 50. I think it was 54, they stopped it. You know, it's like when you start seeing people dying from your product, whatever the product is, you have to stop giving that product to people, because that's only going to start increasing as the numbers of people you give this to increase as well. So we are currently, tomorrow we'll have a new number. We are currently at 7,859 deaths in the domestic VAERS data set. There are two data sets in VAERS. There's domestic and foreign, but I only analyze domestic data. And again, that number goes up pretty evenly every week, something between 1 and 300 people, extra people added to the file. So, we have a lot of anomalies when you compare it to actual vaccines from the past 30 years. And you're also seeing things that indicate causation, i.e., many, many, many reports, in some cases up to 64% of reports being filed within 32 hours of the injection. So this is one of the things that you look for when you examine causality. It's a temporal relationship between potential cause and potential effect. And the shorter that duration is, of course, the more suspicious it is. This is why, you know, anaphylaxis is a good, it's a good adverse event to use if you're looking kind of for a positive control, because anaphylaxis by definition is an acute reaction that happens following a trigger. So you would expect that if the injections were causing the anaphylaxis in certain people that are having anaphylaxis, it would happen very close temporal proximity to the injection. And that's actually exactly what we're seeing. So yeah, there's all sorts of interesting things.
What would you say to folks that might say, well, that in a typical year, that's the 150 deaths in all the vaccines combined in VAERS, and this 7,000 domestic, and if you added the non-domestic, you know, 14 or almost 15,000 now, I think.
Yep.
You know, the argument on the other side is, well, what you just kind of alluded to, the causation, you can't really say it's caused from that. And maybe people are just more aware now and reporting it more. What's your answer to that?
No, that's been checked independently. It's not because there are more injections being given out. The study has been done. And it's also not because of over-reporting, which is what they're calling that.
Right.
That's what I would say. Go read about this on your interweb. There are published and peer-reviewed journals that can verify what I just said. It's not that. This is a massive, big, hand-sewn red flag flying above our ship, and it needs to be acknowledged.
Can you talk a little bit about the lag in the data report? Because as you just mentioned, that we're supposed to see, you know, the system is in place so we can see a signal, a safety signal, and then immediately we can stop the rollout of this experimental medical device. So talk about that a little bit. What are you seeing in terms of a lag in the data being reported?
Well, there are two things I can say about that. I hope that I can remember. The first thing is, even without the lag phase being considered, the numbers are still off the charts. That's the first thing that should be acknowledged. So the people trying to dequalify what we're saying can say, oh, okay. But there is a very real lag phase, and this is my and most people on the ground who told me stories about what the situation is that there's a massive backlog. So there doesn't necessarily have to be talk of nefariousness going on here. This could just be because the system is old. I mean, they created it in 1990. It could just be that people are really overworked, and my heart goes out to you guys entering the SPARES data, because it must be a nightmare. There is a massive backlog, okay? So how that manifests, because humans are entering this data into the system and there aren't enough people doing this apparently, is that massive numbers of VAERS reports, and I do mean hundreds of thousands, that's a lot, are being entered long after the reports were actually originally filed. I've actually shown this in a paper that I should have coming out today, actually, which is about VAERS pharmacovigilance. I show this with pictures and numbers. Best way to show something. There are two sets of data that you can use. If you wanted to know how I did this, there's two sets of data that you can compare to kind of see this very clearly in graphical form. You can look at the updates as they come in per week, and you can look at the most up-to-date file. You would think that the most up-to-date file contains just about every entry that you would get from each weekly update, but you don't. These things are completely separate. Every time a VAERS update is made on Friday, which is tomorrow, and entered into the system, the previous file is overwritten. And again, this isn't due to nefariousness. This is because the system is inefficient. So you have people who have to enter the MedDRA codes, which are the official names for the adverse events. You have to pull information from something called a symptom text file. You have to classify, you know, this and that. So this takes time and it takes effort. And eventually your final data set does end up being very different, but it shouldn't end up being as different as it is. So I don't know if you guys have good visual imaginations here, but picture this. Picture it, Sicily, 1923. I'm just kidding. I love the Golden Girls. You have VAERS updates. You have something like, I don't know, 30 now. So you plot the number of people that die from each one of those updates on a two-dimensional axis. So you have your number of adverse events on the y-axis and your date on the x. And you're going to get something that looks like an exponential curve, more or less. So if you plot the number of people who died for those exact same dates as extracted from the most recent updated file, those two lines should be very, very much the same. But they're really, really, really different. There are two things that are strikingly different about them. One, there's a huge gap in the middle of them if you plot them together on the same axis, which represents question mark data. And that, there's a lot of question mark data. Where is this data? What is that data? Where did it go? Again, not saying there's anything nefarious going on, but there's something kind of wobbly about the system. The second thing that you notice, which is very, very useful information, no matter how broken VAERS is, is that for a certain date, what was actually being reported as the number of deaths was very, very different from the actual number of people that died, for example. So, and if you take severe adverse events in general, let's say you have somebody who's monitoring bears and on the fence about getting these injections or not, or maybe getting their kids injected, and they're watching the severe adverse event count, you know, increase per week, and they judge based on what's being entered into the VAERS system, there's no risk because the number's not going up fast enough. But here's the catch. Those aren't the real numbers. So we're losing a safety signal that was absolutely necessary for somebody to make an informed decision about whether or not to take these, to inject these products into themselves. So that's all I have to say about that.
Okay, so let me translate layman's terms, basically. So if someone jumps on there today, or maybe tomorrow after this new data dump comes out, and they see this domestic death of 7,000, whatever, and they think, okay, there's been 300 million doses given, there's this many deaths, oh, and do the math. What you're saying is those 7,000 deaths actually may have occurred from, say, January through June, not January through August, you know, because of that lag, basically. Yeah. I mean, roughly.
Yeah. Now, there's also a possibility that they're caught up with the log. I don't know. It kind of looks like that when you look at certain isolated adverse events. But like what I'm referring to is back in, say, March. This is when it reared its ugly head in the worst way. The discrepancy, the delta between the reported number of deaths and what the number of deaths actually was based on the entries from the backlog being added to the system was huge. So, and by the way, people, there's something called an underreporting factor, which we're not talking about yet. And there's a whole big thing on that. You can go to the interweb and find out about that. It's the latest thing today. it's very well known and documented that there's underreporting in VAERS. Okay, this is not, you know, a conspiracy theory. This is a fact. Underreporting is a serious problem in VAERS. So what me and a couple other people have done very recently, and this is also in my latest paper coming out, hopefully today or tomorrow, is a calculation of the underreporting factor. So I won't bore you with the details. You can go read it. But it's somewhere between 30 and 40 by everyone's best guess. So every number that I've quoted here, you really probably should multiply by about 35. And that's how you'll arrive at a better estimate of how many people, say, have died. And according to me and my colleagues, that number is somewhere near 200,000 people in the U.S. That's just the U.S. We could be wrong. This is an estimate for now. But we've done this. A number of people have done this using different methods, and we've all come to the same approximate conclusion. So that's pretty strong evidence. It's kind of exciting because no one's ever had an opportunity to kind of figure out, like, what is the actual underreporting factor in VAERS? You know, is it 1% as reported by the Pilgrim study, or is it something higher? Like, so yeah, we've been able to come up with a pretty good approximation. And this is the way that I did it was using the FDA, it's an FDA report of the Pfizer phase 3 trial. So the original BN2 product from Pfizer BioNTech. So I use their own data to show what this underreporting factor is. So if they want to tell me that I'm wrong, then they have to explain to me why using their data.
Yeah. And I know Steve Kirsch also, I think it was him, just looking at some of that very...
One of the people I'm talking about, yeah.
Yeah. So even just considering the very small initial group, I think 18,000 in the Pfizer group, maybe, all-cause mortality, just as simple as that. How many people died in the placebo group versus the vaccinated group? And I forget the exact number, but the dying from anything in that group, there were more that died in the vaccine group than the placebo group. So that alone, it should raise an eyebrow. But then you continue to follow this data out, like Dr. Rose has, looking at the FDA Pfizer data itself about the adverse events that were reported. And then you can extrapolate that out from a percent standpoint. The percentage of people in that initial group that reported a severe adverse reaction, you look at all-cause mortality. So, you know, they could have died from a heart attack, and that would go into, obviously, all-cause mortality. So that's the kind of thing these guys and gals have been looking at independently. Like Dr. Rose has looked at it, Steve Kirsch has looked at it, and others have looked at it. And I want to see if
he's genius, and he did the same thing, and he found the same thing that we did. So,
yeah. And these are PhD level statisticians, mathematicians, pretty smart guys. Do you have a comment on the McLaughlin paper, Scott McLaughlin, the name of the paper, Analysis of COVID-19 Vaccine Death Reports from the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System? Specifically, he found, or his group found, 86% of the deaths had no other explanation than the vaccine. So I think they went through and actually read the narrative of each report in the VAERS system. If people aren't familiar, the doctor, the nurse, which I think I've heard 80% of these reports are actually medical professionals who go in and fill these out. Doctors or nurses were so convinced that it was the injection that did this, they log on to this very cumbersome system and take the time to fill it out. In reading that narrative, this McLaughlin paper stated they couldn't find any other reason, meaning the person just walked into a vaccine center, perfectly healthy, was administered the vaccine, and I think 50% died within the first 24 hours, or maybe it's 3 days, I don't remember, but any comments on some of those statistics?
Yeah, well, I found the same thing doing a completely different analysis of my own. Those guys are in Britain? I don't know, I might be wrong. Anyway, yeah. I didn't even know about that. And I used my Bradford Hill criteria, and I plotted the delta between the vax date and the onset date, say death, against the percentage of adverse events reported. And I found that, like I said, up to 64% of reports were filed within 32 to 48 hours. That's not how, you know, that to me is very suspicious when you're talking about, like people being hardcore opinion that there's no link between the injections and the onset of symptoms. I mean, come on, you kind of can't say that. And if you are going to say that, you have to show it, you know, in a way that's convincing. You have to use statistics. You have to use mathematics. You have to do something. You can't just say, no, you can't do that because it says so in there. Also, they showed an important thing that they showed in that paper is, I think it was 67% of the reports were filed by medical professionals. So this came up earlier in our conversation, you and me, about the simulated reporting. You know, people are, hey, maybe it's just because people are entering fake data. No, that's called simulated reporting. And their paper also showed that for the most part, the reports are being filed by medical professionals. The rest of them are probably being filed by family members, and there are a lot of duplicate entries, but this is one of the jobs of the people who entered the data, which is why it takes so long and why there can be mistakes. So I forgive them for that completely. But I'm not sure you mentioned it yet, but it's really important for people to know. Personally, I'm going to say my personal opinion now. The very first question a physician asks a patient that comes to them when they're suffering a certain kind of incident that they hadn't had previously, like a cardiac incident, is, when did you get injected? That should be number one question, because you have to start thinking that way right now. And it's illegal if you are a physician and you suspect that your patient is suffering an adverse event not to report it to VAERS. You have to do that as a physician. And again, I know that people are overwhelmed, and I can't imagine how overwhelmed they are. I, I'm I'm trying not to pass too much judgment, but I'm hearing too many stories about people who go to their doctors and they actually have to ask, is it possible? I got my injection 4 days ago. Is it possible that my leg is swollen to twice its size because of that? And in many cases, I kid you not, people, these are people I know, they're being told to get out of the GP's office, that they can't say things like that. Explain that to me from any point of view, why that is something that's happening right now.
Yeah. It's definitely happening. I had someone seek out care at our clinic. They weren't previously a patient. The father called me because his 13-year-old child was injected with the Pfizer vaccine or gene therapy. And 48 hours later, she fell asleep, and she continued to sleep 22 out of 24 hours for the next 28 days. When he called me, we're well into 30 plus days now. And she returned to her physician that administered the injection. And he said, no, there's no relationship to the injection. So she was referred to some specialists at the local medical school, and a team of doctors, according to the father, came in to examine the child, really didn't have any good answer as far as a diagnosis or treatment plan, but were very confident it had nothing to do with the injection. That's about an obvious of a correlation case right there. Perfectly healthy, an energetic child, and 48 hours later, a dramatic change. And I hear all the time, so-and-so went in, got an injection, 2 days later had a heart attack, or a day later had a heart attack.
Not related.
So the underreporting, just from anecdotal stories that I hear locally, but then obviously y'all don't just do anecdotal. You use your statistical analysis through various different methods, as Dr. Rose has pointed out, Steve Kirsch has pointed out, the 4 or 5 different conclusions by different professionals using different methods points to the same thing. And then Dr. Bart Clausen produced a paper, U.S. COVID-19 vaccines proven to cause more harm than good based on pivotal clinical trial data analyzed using the proper scientific endpoint, which is all-cause mortality or morbidity. You can go look at that paper too. And basically what we're saying, guys, with all-cause, you know, let's keep this simple. Say there's a new drug out for blood clots. You know, you have atrial fibrillation, you get blood clots. So you need to be on a drug for that to prevent your blood clot. So this new medicine comes out and you get on it, and yep, it thins your blood and can prevent a clot. But what if it thins it too much and you bleed to death from a gastrointestinal bleed? Well, we need to know, what are the odds of you bleeding to death versus the odds of you getting a clot or not getting the clot? And obviously, if you more people bleed to death than are preventing from having a stroke from the blood clot, you probably don't want to approve that drug nor take that drug. So that's what we're talking about. Is the medical procedure, device, or medicine causing more death than what it's preventing? And what Dr. Rose is saying and these other doctors are saying is, yes, it's causing an extreme amount of death. And again, remember, we got to frame the conversation. If this was a super deadly virus, this was the only therapy or medical device available to help combat it, you know, that's one thing. Yep. The mortality rate on this virus, and yes, I know it kills people, and yes, it's killed people in Lubbock, Texas, and yes, some were even young, but it's a pandemic of the untreated. That's another conversation that actually we've already had. So we need to keep that in mind. We're dealing with something that's an experimental device. And Dr. Rose, I've heard you in another interview. Could you just touch on traditionally, looking back historically, what would a medical device have to go through, or a pharmaceutical have to go through, in terms of phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, and animal trials, and the length of these trials, and, you know, data safety monitoring boards, et cetera, versus what we've seen with this one?
Right. So I outlined this pretty slowly in a video I just posted on YouTube. You can find it by going to Jessica Rose's CCCA. CCCA is the Canadian COVID Care Alliance. So this is how it goes. Biologicals and pharmaceuticals don't go through the same processes to get to humans. Pharmaceuticals go through hell. Biologicals go through nothing, which makes no sense, because biologicals, for the most part, are injected intramuscularly. Look that up. So typically, a vaccine, a true vaccine, which is an attenuated or killed version of a pathogen, virus, say, okay? You take the actual virus. Viruses are made up of like proteins. They have an outside membrane, and they have little prongs like spikes, and they have all sorts of different antigenic proteins that your body will recognize when it gets into your body, and the immune system will do its thing. So it's a brilliant concept. You have a low level of infection because the pathogen is dead. And to go from, you know, an idea, you know, hey, I want to develop a vaccine against this thing, to getting it into humans takes between 10 and 15 years, typically. It's a long process. And it's a very sequentially monitored process. You have phase 1 through phase 4 clinical trials. Phase 4 is like safety monitoring the population. And before phase 1, if you even get to phase 1, you have to have animal trials. Let's see how this does in animals, okay? So there's development of your product. How are you going to deliver it? What mechanism of action does it have? Then you put it into animals. If the animals don't die, okay, you move to phase 1. Small amount of people, volunteer, massive exclusion criteria list, which means the people who are not allowed to participate, which includes pregnant women every single time, lactating women, women of childbearing age, people with autoimmune conditions. The list is very, very long. Even if you smoke, you can't be in the center, okay? So this takes 1 to 2 years, and then your phase 2, if you get there, is a lot more people, up to 2 years, and then you get to phase 3, it's a few more years. So, and these are sequential processes that you have to go through, have strictly monitored by agencies like the Center for Biologics, FDA, CDC, whatever. These are strictly monitored. And then only at the end can you get approval for your product, say FDA approval, and have this product put into humans. It's meant to be rigorous because we don't want to put something into humans that's going to cause more harm than good. That would be dumb, right? So what we've had with this COVID stuff, number one, this isn't a true vaccine for two reasons. One, what it is, it's not a killed pathogen. It's the mRNA template of a protein, which is the spike protein of this coronavirus, okay, wrapped in a lipid nanoparticle. Both of these things have never been put into humans before, okay? Lots and lots and lots of long-term safety data should have been done in humans and animals before this was put into humans, because neither of these things have been done. Number two, a true vaccine is supposed to provide protective immunity and stop transmission. That's the whole point. Low level of infection, you know, no symptoms, you can't give it to other people, pathogen eradicated, you know, that's the theory. So we got through this entire process that's supposed to take on average 10 years in about a year, six months to a year. Rushed is not a word. You guys all heard about Operation Warp Speed. So that's what that means. This was super rushed. And the reason it was super rushed is because in March, the WHO declared a global pandemic. And we thought we were dealing with a very dangerous pathogen. We needed to rush this stuff, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's the claim, okay? So what we're dealing with here, it turns out, is, like I said, it's a brand new mode of of introduction to the human, these lipid nanoparticles, and a brand new means of stimulating the immune system with the mRNA template of a protein that your body uses this template and uses its own machinery to generate these spike proteins. And what we're learning now, because the studies are being done now after the fact, after half the human population has been injected with this stuff, is that the spike protein itself is highly pathogenic. The LNPs, the lipid nanoparticles, have been shown by a Japanese group to be heavily systematically biodistributed in the body. They're landing in the ovaries at the highest concentrations and the adrenal glands. And I don't know if you guys know what the adrenals do and how important they are, but that's really not good because we don't know what the effects are. We don't know if at those sites where the LNPs are bioaccumulating, if more spike protein is being produced, and that's what's causing, say, female infertility issues arising, because this is a thing. So I know that I turned that into a long explanation, but I just can't stress this enough. These aren't weird ideas that a small group of people are just like shouting about because they're anti-vax. No one is anti-vax. People are anti-dangerous products getting into humans too early, before long-term data has been accumulated. I'm telling everyone from the bottom of my heart, I've been in this thing for 30 years, that there's no long-term safety data on these products. I'm just going to turn on my light. Safety data on these products, and the efficacy data looks very bad.
Yeah. And I do want to comment, you know, 20 years ago when SARS-CoV-1 came out, multiple countries dumped millions and millions of dollars into trying to develop a vaccine for a coronavirus. And in the animal trials, multiple different animal trials by multiple different companies, they failed. In some of the trials, it was 100% death rate from adverse reactions. So coronaviruses are notoriously difficult to vaccinate against. But then the lipid nanoparticle technology, which is separate, as Dr. Rose has pointed out, Moderna was messing around or experimenting with lipid nanoparticle delivery of mRNA for certain genetic diseases where there's missing genes, missing genetic information. And, you know, I support considering looking at that. Let's give these very rare genetic disorder patients, you know, a gene therapy product injected every 6 months to deliver these genes to see what happens. But Moderna came out, I think it was 2018, and told their investors, sorry, guys, we're going to scrap this lipid nanoparticle RNA delivery system, mRNA, because the adverse events are just too significant. So that's the historical background. We've got data historically that says these things are really dangerous, and there has been no data produced that tells us they've overcome this issue. And now we're saying we're a year into administering these almost, and we have multiple people screaming that the data is screaming, big problem, red flag, 200,000 deaths in America alone. We're killing more people than we're saving with this medical therapy. So I know we got to wrap it up because you've got to go feed your cats, but I'm married to a cat loving woman and I've got some cat loving kids. So I know all about cats. I'm not the cat man. Cats.
Yeah. It's a mom who I saw I saw her get pregnant, actually, not physically, but before and after she grew. And then one day she had these three little faces crawled out from under this rock, literally. And I've been taking care of them ever since because mama needs help, and they're living on the beach and people are not nice to them. And so I feed them twice a day and it's killing me, but I can't stop.
you love animals, you love cats, and you love people. And that's why you're putting your name and your reputation out there, and you're screaming for people to consider the safety on this. If you have time, just shortly, briefly, we could talk about efficacy. You mentioned that it looks like the efficacy, which means, does this even work? Does it? I mean, honestly, they told us from the beginning, this isn't really designed to keep you from catching coronavirus. It's not designed to keep you from transmitting it to anybody, but they didn't tell the people that very loudly, all the billboards and commercials and the coercion and the bribing. I haven't met a vaccinated patient yet where I've asked them, did they inform you prior to the injection that this would not prevent you from getting the coronavirus or transmitting to grandma? And to a man and woman, they say, no, they didn't tell me that.
Nope.
So efficacy in terms of what they've told us is this is supposed to reduce severe disease, hospitalization, and death. And Israel probably is the best place to look because they're so highly vaccinated and now into their third booster, I believe. So what say you, Dr. Rose, on the efficacy portion of this coin?
So first of all, when you get the thing that you're injecting yourself in order not to get, that's called a breakthrough infection. And breakthrough infection cases are off the charts. They have been growing since the beginning. So people have been getting COVID despite being injected from the beginning, and Bears shows that very, very, very nicely. Now, if you just look at one of the most injected places on the planet, which is Israel, and you look at what's going on there now, what you're going to find from our world in data is that nobody who's been double dosed, which is most of the population here, has any protective immunity against this Delta strain, okay? So 80-something percent, I think the latest statistic was, of people who are positive cases or in the hospital are double injected. That translates to a vaccine failure in terms of protective immunity. So besides the fact that it doesn't prevent you from getting this thing, and it doesn't prevent you from passing it on to someone, and it doesn't give you protective immunity against wild type variants or new variants, two bad things can happen here. One, you could actually be suffering mal effects from the product itself, in addition to it not working at all. And number two, on a population scale, we could actually be driving variants of concern to emerge. Because if you kind of like massively inject this population here and not so much this one, and this is what's happening, we can see it. The emergence of this Delta strain, so-called variant. Sorry, it's not a strain, it's a variant. I have to take that back. Not a strain, it's a variant. It originated in India, allegedly, moved to the UK, went to Israel. So the if you look at next strain, I hope everybody does this because it's beautiful. It's an interactive phylogenetic tree database. You can actually look at when these variants were emerging on a timeline. And then you can map that against, okay, when did the injection rollout start in this country, in that country, in that country? And you can cross-reference these. You can actually answer that question pretty well. Like, are these rollouts driving the emergence of variants? And there's variants, and then there's variants of concern, which is what, you know, the people in the field call the baddies. Like, not the variants that are more readily transmittable, but the ones that are more virulent, which would be really bad. We've been lucky so far in terms of this, and this virus, you know, that it doesn't affect kids, doesn't affect you if you're healthy. Basically, doesn't do anything to many people. The mortality rate is very low. We've been lucky. And I think people need to really think about that, like when they're fear factored by the media. Like, what are you afraid of exactly? Is there a deadly pathogen? No, there's not. There's not. There's a dying economy. There are people committing suicide. There are people suffering terrible, debilitating, lifelong adverse events from these products. There's censorship going on. There's a whole bunch of bad stuff going on. But I'm going to tell you, it's not because of a deadly virus. It's not. That's categorical truth right there. I'm not saying that terrible viruses don't exist. And I'm also, like I just said, not saying that another one's not on the way. But right now, if we don't deal with this using common sense, using good doctoring, like preventative medicine, for example, acknowledgement of the fact that most people who die from COVID are vitamin D deficient. Like, it could just be as simple as that. I mean, yeah, it's about transparency, and it's about informed consent. That's about all I have to say.
Yeah. Amen. Informed consent is where I camp out, because if people knew the truth and were fully informed, then they can make their decision. And I'm all for people who volunteer their body to science. I remember in medical school, gross anatomy lab, we had a cadaver we had to work on for the advancement of my academic knowledge and my practice. We had practice patients come in so we could practice examining these patients, including pelvic exams and rectal exams, and, you know, give your body to science. That's a that's a honorable thing to do. And people decide to do that, want to do that, and be a part of some, experiment or some trial, therapeutic trial on a pharmaceutical or new medical device. Not against it, but I am against coercion, bribery, fear mongering, And then taking the vulnerable that you mentioned that are always excluded traditionally, pregnant women, women that could become pregnant, lactating mothers through the breast milk, what's going to be transmitted, and especially children, children who are under the care of an adult, to coerce, to force, to ridicule, to, I mean, there are professors in colleges, even here locally, that have shamed students that won't get this emergency authorized. And I do just want to say that, guys, there's nothing available that's been approved. What was approved, and that's a different show we don't have time for, but let me just say what's approved is not available. This, I don't even know how to say it, the C word.
I looked up how to say it etymologically. I don't know what the etymology of this word is, but it's pronounced Comirnaty.
So I don't know what the word games and what the legalities and all that, they approved this thing, but it's not available. And then they extended the emergency authorization of Pfizer. Everybody thinks that's approved. It's not. And then a day or two later, you get the two top FDA officials in the vaccine department.
Quitting.
Been there for 20 or 30 years. They quit. And now we have an FDA panel. We have scientists testifying to the FDA panel last week that there's potentially 200,000 deaths, roughly, based off good statistical analysis by different, you know, coming at it from different directions. You know, it's just crazy, really. And so what's the public left to do? And if they're watching conventional news media, what they're left to do is go get the vaccine. So that is why we're doing this show, so we can bring people an alternative and more robust and debatable. All this is up for debate, and that's my final point, and then we'll let Dr. Rose give her final point. My final point is all this is debatable, so let's have an open discussion and debate, and let's not give the benefit of the doubt to the company that I think it's at $30 or $40 billion now. They've made a blockbuster drug is defined by $1 billion in 1 year of revenue. And we're over $30 billion now for Pfizer. Let's not give that company the benefit of the doubt. And let's not give the regulatory agencies that get, I think that Pfizer paid $3 million to the FDA to fast track this thing. And I like people to remember Pfizer's a convicted criminal. They've paid the highest fines, criminal and civil fines, in the history of the world. So we've got a company with a known criminal record of lying, bribing. We have billions and billions of dollars at stake, and what appears to be potentially captured agencies, if not highly influenced by these millions of dollars. So that alone should leave this as an open public debate. Conventional media should be allowing all this information out so people could at least pause and take a second. Dr. Rose, I'll give you the last word.
I think that people should stop believing that organizations and corporations care about them, because these aren't people. The only thing that can care about you are living beings. And I think you should listen to, even if it's one living being in your life who's saying, who's questioning anything about this, I think you should listen to them. Because they're the ones who are going to care about you and maybe care for you if something goes wrong. These companies and corporations won't. They've made themselves unliable. They've made sure. Okay? So listen to people. People are the ones who can hug you. The corporations cannot. Those are my final words.
All right. Dr. Jessica Rose, how can people follow your work? I know you give routine, maybe weekly updates. What's the best way to find you?
So I've created a website where you can see the live update on Friday in the form of pretty pictures. And you can also find my CV and all my interviews. That's where you'll find this one at https://i/do/not/consent.netlify.app. Maybe we can put that in the subtext.
Yes, it will be in the summary, guys. So y'all check that out below. Dr. Rose, thank you. I know you've spent a lot of time and effort and will most likely continue to for the love of humanity and your fellow man and woman. Thank you very much. Appreciate you. Would love to have you back on the show someday.
I'd love to come back. It's been great.
All right. Okay, everybody. Dr. Ben Edwards here. You're the cure. Come back next week. We'll have another great show. Bye-bye.